As the Mayflower, and later the Arabella, sailed from England to New England, the Puritans aboard had a clear metaphor for their journey, the Exodus. This is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz, your host for Wyoming Catholic College's After Dinner Scholar podcast. It may seem strange that at the Wyoming School of Catholic Thought this past June, we listened to a lecture about the New England Puritans, a group of extremely low church Calvinists. Yet as Dr. Virginia Arbery, Associate Professor of Humanities, pointed out, the Puritan self-understanding is the root of our American self-understanding. Their sense of exodus from England, the wilderness, the new beginning in the new world to found a city on a hill, a new Jerusalem, remains with us today. Dr. Virginia Arbery is my guest on this edition of the After Dinner Scholar. Dr. Arbery, why in a program about the imagination, and specifically the Catholic imagination, did you choose to discuss those Calvinist Puritans and pilgrims at the Massachusetts Bay Colony?
That's a wonderful question, Jim, and I think the fundamental answer is that their understanding of the Bible, of the role of Moses, of the terrific slavery under which his people suffered, their careful imagining of that experience of no freedom, of trusting in God's word through his representative, of going through the wilderness and making their promise and then anticipating the promised land, that imaginative experience informed their own in almost a one-to-one relationship.
What was going on historically and theologically that shaped that imagination? What was going on in England?
So we have the movement of Protestantism, which was frustrated with the Anglican attempt to purify those forms connected with Roman Catholicism. The vestments, the hierarchy, the great deal of ritual, the teaching authority of a church separate from sola scriptura, the governing insight of Protestantism. And so frustrated with the effects of Queen Elizabeth's latent love for the aesthetic part of Roman Catholicism, they sought to purify that set of practices with a very strict, what later would be called congregational approach, where the covenanted people of a small community prove their witness of the Spirit speaking to each of them, and then join through explicit consent a community which as a whole then covenants with God. And so these separate organizations, sometimes called separatists if they followed Brown, and sometimes just called Puritan if they were less strict, came to be, as it were, a foundation for American liberty, as Perry Miller, the great scholar of the Puritan mind, points out. By building a church on consent, by agreement, paralleling, they thought, the covenant of the people of Israel with God, by building a church on that, they also set a kind of habit of liberty, which we have, which is based on consent of the people. So those English roots are fundamental. The separatists, as you know, separated first from England and went to the Netherlands and ended up in Plymouth, Massachusetts. And then the other group, coming 10 years later in 1630 under Governor Winthrop, started in the Boston area, and that was a less strict, though from all accounts very strict in its own right, group of Puritans.
Well, it seems to me that the separatists, the pilgrims that came to Plymouth, kind of Puritans with a real attitude.
Well, you know, when you read the Mayflower Compact, which is a beautiful short paragraph, beginning with, in the name of God, that composition that Bradford oversaw, assigned by 41 males on the Mayflower, gives an insight into how difficult the members of that group were. He was already seeing faction and dissension on the boat. So before they got off, he composed this compact, which made them agree later to the laws they would form, and which specified their commitment to the advancement of the faith and to the glory of God and to their better ordering. That document, I think, shows in the historical document that Bradford wrote, giving an account of it, shows that these were strong individuals, right? Very determined to build what later would be called by Winthrop the city upon the hill. And they were very, as you suggest, strict with one another. Their wills, given the assumptions of Protestantism, could easily move to further separations from one another, which we certainly saw in their neighbor organization of the Boston area, the Massachusetts Bay Colony, later under Winthrop.
Tell us some more about the biblical imagery that they employed when they wrote about their experiences and about their leaders.
Yes, that is extraordinary. When you read Cotton Mather's account on this whole expedition, Christi Magnalia Americana, you see that they understood themselves generations later and at the time as repeating the experience of the people of Israel. So both Bradford and Winthrop, 10 years apart, as I said, 1620 and 1630, are talked about as Moses figured, right? The people in the wilderness need a Moses to lead them. They're also talked about as a kind of Nehemiah, the figure who reestablishes the Jewish people after the Babylonian captivity. So they're reestablishing what was lost in Christendom with Roman Catholicism. Their claims are also couched in classical terms, which we sometimes ignore in talking about the biblical Protestant roots of those first settlements. And that that classical part is extraordinary. Bradford and Winthrop were fluent in Greek language, in the Latin language, and Hebrew. Also, in the case of Bradford, in the Dutch and the French. These are men that studied Plutarch, who understood their work in Platonic terms. So the references throughout Cotton Mather's account of his ancestors are laced with the references to the lives of the great Greeks and Romans as much as they are with the great figures in the biblical tradition.
On the biblical tradition side, how do we see notions of Exodus, the wilderness, covenant, and promised land manifest, not just in the Puritans, but in ongoing American history? For example, are notions such as American exceptionalism, manifest destiny, go west, young man, America's outsized role in world affairs, and so on. Are those rooted in this founding story?
Yes, I think so. I was very struck in preparing thoughts for our adults who visited with us at the Wyoming School of Catholic Thought. I was very struck this time by the correspondence between the beautiful phrase that is taken from the Sermon on the Mount by Winthrop, the city upon the hill, in the model of Christian charity, the speech that Winthrop gives on the Arabella. I was very struck by the convergence of the Old Testament and the New Testament consciously on the part of these early founders, pre-founders, I should say, of the American sensibility, and then how that image lasts. Chaput, the great Archbishop of Philadelphia, in his recent book, Charles Chaput, talks about the renewal of Christian culture as a return to that notion of a city upon the hill. We see this term used throughout the American presidency as well. We see it in Calvin Coolidge, a president with whom I'm getting to be more and more familiar and liking more and more, because he didn't insist on the presidency as the important institution in our government. Not only he, but also John F. Kennedy. We see it, of course, in Ronald Reagan, all through his campaign and in his presidency, hoping to restore the notion of the city upon the hill. We see it in the civil rights movement with Martin Luther King. We all know about his talk where he has a dream and positions himself as a kind of Moses on Mount Pisgah, looking on but not quite seeing in his own experience what that new revival of freedom for his own people would be. It's lays throughout. Even Barack Obama uses the term, interestingly, when he's speaking to the University of Massachusetts commencement and mentions that as he looks upon the crowd and sees the diverse population, that this is the fulfillment of the city upon the hill. So it's used for all kinds of things and not always strictly in conformity with how the Puritans saw it, which is really a world that they're describing governed not by law, really, so much as by charity.
Certainly what Augustine saw.
Yeah, and I'm struck all the time by the correspondence between, in fact, Catholic theology and the theology that is the provides the principles in the model of Christian charity by Bradford. In fact, some of our participants in the Wyoming School of Catholic Thought were saying, you know, this sounds like St. Paul, it sounds like Augustine, I think it sounds like Bernard of Clairvaux. The tradition is not lost entirely by the Puritans. It's tweaked. It's definitely not one with the Catholic tradition. In fact, it gets its energy from being in opposition to it. But to the extent that they're Christian, to that extent they're in conformity to the imaginative vision and thought of Catholicism.
Well, I know when I was a good heir of the Puritans as a Reformed pastor, Presbyterian pastor, I started to identify myself more as an Augustinian than a Calvinist.
And, there's the bridge, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's the bridge across the Tiber, is what it is.
But it is definitely it is, and they're also, though they certainly reject scholasticism, they're also organized intellectually by the forms of scholasticism. If you read the model of Christian charity from the beginning, not the part that's just excerpted in most textbooks, it reads like an article in St. Thomas Aquinas. I mean, it's organized in terms of a claim and a contrary, and then meeting the contraries and then affirming the claim. It's very much in the tradition of scholastic thought, laced with a different theology at times, but they're dependent on that whole tradition as much as they oppose it.
Well, you see that even 100 years later or so in Jonathan Edwards.
Oh, yes. Absolutely. The way the argument goes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Very Thomistic.
It is. Yeah.
Now, do those images continue to inform our national identity, or is that all changing? Are we in a different era at this point?
Yes, this goes back to your question about exceptionalism. I do think we are struggling to retain a sense of our own purpose that the Puritans, as Tocqueville pointed out, gave us. It says that first footprint of the first Puritan off the Mayflower informs the whole direction that America will take. Why? Why have we lost this? Well, I don't think we cherish liberty in the same way that either the people of Israel did, that the Lord did, or that the Puritans on both boats did. And we've lost that partly because of materialism and the secularism and all the isms that we claim have ruined us, but also behind that loss is the fact that educationally we no longer teach the story. In fact, we undermine the story. For years, my husband, Dr. Glenn Arbery, and I have been teaching teachers, and we're amazed at how easy it is to recover what they've been told is a lie about America, and that is that it is great, that it is unusual, that it is a special moment in history in the way that Jerusalem was, and Athens was, and Rome was. And to recover that is easier than you would think if you tell the story. And the story hasn't been told. We've lost the narrative. We've been embarrassed by it. It's been subverted by those who have really, I would say, a utopian vision, a vision that thinks, well, if it wasn't perfect from the outset, if it wasn't absolutely equal from the outset, then it couldn't be true. It was a lie. In fact, that utopian vision has been either through a socialistic thought or progressive thought. It's been the problem in education, and it's been the reason why future citizens aren't given to understand that they've been born into a great and noble enterprise.
Which is partly why we have Wyoming Catholic College and the After Dinner Scholar podcast.
Absolutely. And thank you for making this possible.
Well, thank you. For more details and analysis, you can listen to Dr. Virginia Arbery's entire lecture, which is posted as a podcast for your convenience. We are entered into covenant with God for this work, John Winthrop wrote on the Arabella as it crossed the Atlantic in 1630. Now if the Lord shall please hear us, he went on, and bring us in peace to the place we desire, then hath he ratified this covenant and sealed our commission, and will expect a strict performance of the articles contained in it. But if we shall neglect the observations of these articles, which are the ends we have propounded, and dissembling with our God shall fall to embrace this present world and prosecute our carnal intentions, seeking great things for ourselves and our posterity, the Lord will surely break out in wrath against us and be revenged on such a people and make us know the price of the breach of such a covenant. Close quote. Bracing stuff. Bracing stuff that perhaps bears repeating in our day. For Wyoming Catholic College, this is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz.